listening to KRFP Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 on your FM dial. Quick weather update for you. Looks like we're going to be getting wet again this evening. Chance of showers into tomorrow. Looks like a possibility of snow a little higher up. Low of 39 this evening. And tomorrow, a low of 29. It's going to be partly sunny going into Friday evening. And then a slight chance of rain, and looking like a lot more rain over the weekend. Lows in the mid-30s, highs about 45, 50 degrees.
There you have it.
November on the Palouse. Well, this is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Thanks for joining us. A couple quick announcements. A couple important happenings this evening. One happening at the Hamilton Low Rec Center on Mountain View Park next to the pool there. There will be a water seminar, evening water seminar. Moscow, the city of Moscow is putting this on. It's going from 6 to 8 p.m., talking about water issues in this area. And as you probably all know, water is an important issue right now, and lots has been happening. Concern for the area's aquifers here. Also this evening at 7:30 at the 1912 building on East 3rd, Palouse Audubon Society is having a presentation. Their monthly meeting will be a presentation by Dr. Nicole Finch of Wazoo over there. She's with the vet clinic and a professor in animal sciences. She's going to be talking about raptor rehabilitation. And you'll get take a look at some of those feathered friends that the WSU Raptor Club has over there as educational birds. So it should be pretty neat.
Well, it'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, at 7:30. Well, we've got another show lined up for you today.
Yeah, we sure do. Well,
we're going to be talking about...
And as usual, we have to make our little disclaimer. This does not represent any organization views.
That's right.
Gary and Will here speaking. Although we've been known to represent organizations in the past, this is done on our own.
That's right. That's right. And our guests as well.
Our guests as well. Their opinions. This is public radio at its best.
That's right. Okay, well, we're going to be talking about some visionary legislation out there. Some good legislation, good conservation legislation actually exists.
It does. It does. It hasn't passed.
It's actually in the House right now.
It's in the House, and with these changes that happened, we might see some action this coming session of Congress.
We're going to be talking about this piece of legislation, and we're going to be talking about one of those... little known species of the Clearwater. If you do know this species, you might have a negative impression of it. I'll just leave you hanging on that.
All right.
We're going to be talking, we're going to give out an elk burger, we're going to give away a couple Whoppers.
Whoppers.
You know it. And
talk a little bit about our special feature here.
Oh, that's right.
The peak of the week.
The peak of the week.
We're going to have one that we're going to have some, we're going to want to hear from callers maybe in the off time on this. If anybody has an, well, even on the air, we're not so good at this. But the question we're going to be asking people is this the highest peak in the Clearwater drainage?
We got a quiz today.
I believe it is, but I'm not 100% certain because Clearwater is a big drainage and there's some unnamed peaks in places like on the Bitterroot Crest between Idaho and Montana there. But this peak might actually be the highest highest point, though I'm not 100% certain. So if somebody's done their topo map research, they might have an answer for us. So that's a kind of a little background on our peak of the week.
Cool. Well, let's jump in, Gary. Let's jump in and talk about RPA, shall we?
RPA, the Rockies Prosperity Act.
All right.
Formerly known as the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, as NEREPA. Since so many people call it that, who knows, the name may change back. I think that's undecided. Depends what Congress decides to do.
I don't really care about the name.
Yeah, I'm not so much wed to any name. I like what it has to say, though. And this is perhaps the most visionary piece of legislation for the Rockies that's ever been conceded for the Wild Rockies bioregion, which includes, of course, most of Idaho, with the exception of some of the southern part of the state and southwest part. But the Rockies bioregion, that part's in, again, the some of that desert, high desert country. But the Rockies bioregion includes most of Idaho, good half of, third of Montana, that northwest part of Wyoming, and some of the eastern fringes of Oregon and Washington in the U.S. Of course, it stretches up into British Columbia and Alberta, and maybe bumping up, you know, the kind of the Yellowstone to Yukon idea, bumping up to the Yukon and I guess right there, that Northwest Territories country up there. So that's, it's a huge region. But in the U.S., we call it the Wild Rockies bioregion, rather than Northern Rockies, because that gets a little confusing. We call it the Northern Rockies here, but you go across the border, and for Canada, it's the Southern Rockies where they live, even though it's to the north. So for the U.S. Northern Rockies, we have to qualify that. But it's for this area of the United States, that five-state region on the National Forests and other public lands in there. And there, it's an exciting piece of legislation. We expect it to be reintroduced once Congress starts up again here next year at some point in time. It may have some changes in what it is now, but right now it's currently H.R. 1204, I believe is the number, the Rockies Prosperity Act. It's introduced in the House of Representatives. The main sponsor now is a bipartisan bill. I think we need to mention that, Will.
Yeah.
The main sponsor is actually Representative Chris Shays. He's fallen in love with this part of the world, he's a Republican, and his co-sponsor is Carolyn Maloney, a Democrat. And it's a little bit unfortunate that none of the local representatives want to be on board with some visionary legislation, but we ought to kind of run down sort of what it does. And it designates the roadless areas on the National Forest System, the large ones, on the BLM, as wilderness, these deserving areas. That's one of the things it does do in this bioregion. So it goes on. It takes an ecosystem approach in looking at various ecosystems here. We've got, of course, the Wild Clearwater Country is part of what we call the Big Wild. Some people call it the Greater Salmon Selway ecosystem, Selway being the main, one of the main tributaries of the Clearwater. Just two S's there, I think, kind of make it sound nice, Greater Salmon Selway. Sometimes it's called the Greater Salmon Clearwater ecosystem. But it's the biggest one in the lower 48, nearly intact. It's even bigger than the Greater Yellowstone, which is also in this system, or the Greater Northern Continental Divide ecosystem. Which is up around Glacier, Bob Marshall country. And those are the three, they call them the three, some people call them the three big sister ecosystems in the lower 48, being the most, in some ways, the most diverse and intact. I don't know about, in terms of wild critters and what's there. We also have a couple other ones, the Cabinet Yak Selkirk ecosystem. Still a few caribou in that one. Although heavily fragmented, and of course the Greater Hells Canyon, Blue Mountains region, and although that some might think that's part of the Big Wild as well, it kind of merges in there, coming from Oregon, the Blues, then you come across the Snake River Gorge, and then kind of into the Salmon River country right after that, after the ridge. It's hard to, ecosystem boundaries really aren't hard fixed lines. So it takes an ecosystem approach to designating wilderness. So that's one of the things it does. Another thing it does is it makes biological connecting corridors, and it prescribes management for those areas, goals of reducing road mileage in the already eroded terrain within these connecting corridors. So it lays out a system of corridors on public land. This bill doesn't affect private land, and it can't. Congress, I guess the Constitution rules on that. But what this bill does on public land is it requires that certain things be met so that there can be genetic interchange, so there can be consistent. And when people think of corridors, they think of maybe a grizzly bear that's in Yellowstone taking a big long walk up to maybe the Clearwater. That's not exactly what they mean by a corridor, although it could happen in the case of some far-ranging species like maybe a wolverine or a wolf. But usually what is meant by these corridors is that there's continuous habitat that is populated by these species between the big ecosystems, the big core habitat, so that there can be some eventual genetic exchange between mm-hmm. the two.
Allows for dispersal.
Dispersal, exactly. Yeah. Genetic dispersal. And I think we have to look at it that way rather than as individuals dispersing from one and going across this kind of corridor to this other place. It's not exactly that, although it could function as such. It's more that there might be two or three or more individuals that might live within these corridors and, you know, that have their own territories within those corridors of some of the larger carnivores, for example. And that's how you get the genetic, over time, that genetic exchange, that dispersal between populations. So it connects corridors together, and we'll talk a little bit about that. One of the other things that it does is it designates wild and scenic rivers, which is really important. And then it sets up a national wildland restoration and recovery system. I think that's a very important aspect to conservation biology here in the Wild Rockies bioregion. And then it has sort of some implementation and monitoring about implementing the legislation. It has some more looking at roadless areas, the smaller ones, seeing what needs to be done with those and asking the agencies to take a look at those. And then it respects the rights of the Indian tribes. So does all those things. In fact, one of the areas that it designates, it's a special area, actually. It's in the Blackfeet, one of their sacred areas in the Badger Two Medicine Country. They're contiguous with the Bob Marshall and Great Bear, just on the east of that, and that has special management provisions there to make sure that those concerns are addressed. So in a nutshell, that's what the bill does. Far-reaching.
Yeah.
And this whole connectivity. And because of that, in the past, there have been hundreds of scientists have signed on supporting this legislation as being visionary and incorporating the principles of conservation biology in our conservation systems. And I think that's, you know, they support that. But at the same time, it also recognizes that wilderness is a wild place, and that we don't need to manipulate it. And so what it does, it incorporates various protective measures, conservation biology, and also the need for wildness in and of itself into a complete and consistent package, which I think is quite unique. So there you have.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the points there that caught my ear, Gary, connectivity being so crucial. When you talk about population dynamics, we've talked a little bit about population dynamics on this show, source and sink populations and dispersal of organisms. And when you have this kind of landscape with a good portion of the land being intact and connected, to be able to have corridors connecting these larger intact places is essential for species survival. And actually, a step above that, even we can even just talk about the health of these populations. If these core areas stay intact, these animal populations can remain healthy, and with connective corridors, they can be maintained as healthy populations, really in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. A lot of mammal species, bird species, but plant species as well. And it also allows natural selection to happen without interruption from you know, manipulation of a landscape. You can allow a lot of the plant hybridization to occur, mm-hmm. and a lot of these rare plants can even have extended ranges because of this kind of protection. Mm-hmm. So it really raises the bar, and I think it's a really excellent piece of legislation. I think another point, excuse me, that you raised was that it's based on ecological boundaries, and just to reiterate the importance of that and how often in today's society we see straight lines, mm-hmm. or kind of convoluted lines that don't follow drainage boundaries, and how important it is to look at a piece of land based on its real boundaries that exist on the physical landscape, and working with those allow natural processes to continue to take place.
And that's really why this is a unique piece of legislation, Will. It is the first that I'm aware of comprehensively to look at a bioregion, and as such, it doesn't follow political or state boundaries. Now, there is some ecological sense to maybe the boundary between Idaho and Montana in some places where it follows that some watershed divides. It follows a continental divide, for example, in a certain place. But ecologically, there are animals that cross over that divide. So it tries to come up with more of an ecological approach in looking at, therefore, all or parts of five states. It incorporates public lands in that area. And talk about the connectivity, a couple of the provisions for the non-wilderness portions, because there are some wilderness areas within these broader corridors that are designated between the large assemblages of wild country, like, you know, the wild Clearwater country. It's not a connecting corridor. It's actually one of the source areas in the wild Clearwater, where we have all those roadless areas are only divided from each other for the most part by individual roads, with a few exceptions. I believe there is a corridor down between the Hell's Canyon country and the Salmon River country through some of those roadless areas that would be designated wilderness around the Slate Creek, John Day country. Mm-hmm. That Salmon River corridor protects those wild Snake Rivers as well. But what it does is it prohibits clear cutting, basically even age silvicultural prescription in the non-wilderness portions. Of course, logging would be prohibited in the wilderness. And it prohibits mining and oil and gas exploration and development and new road construction or reconstruction in those areas. And then what it requires, and this is really interesting scientifically, that federal land management agencies must take immediate steps to ensure that road densities within the corridor approach as nearly as possible 0 miles of roads per square mile in a land area, and not to exceed 0.25 miles per square mile. And they call it the moving window method. And then, of course, there are certain roads like major highways that are not part of that formula. It describes those, you know, federal highways, which it probably can't be. But what it does then is it sets up a template for the agencies, usually the Forest Service or in some cases BLM, to go and begin a process of road removal so we can get to a low road densities to allow that exchange to take place in these areas that aren't wilderness but are still important connecting corridors.
All right, we're going to go into a quick musical break. We'll be back talking more about RPA and getting into the species of the week. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. We're talking about Rocky's Prosperity Act, perhaps the best legislation in the history, really, of this place, for protection of the wild Rockies, Northern Rockies ecosystems. And just had a caller call in and posed a question. This caller wanted to know how this legislation might relate to some of the current bad wilderness bills out there in Congress, CEDRA specifically, and wondering if CEDRA could compromise this bill, or if I have an additional question to that. To pose to just to Gary and also to folks out there, wouldn't it probably do CEDRA's job only better?
Well, actually, the answer to the latter is definitely it would. The Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act, I think, is not the Rockies Prosperity Act or Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, as it was formerly called. As its name implies, it's an economic development act. It gives away public lands, including crucial land within the Sawtooth National Recreation Area, land that was bought from private interests by tax dollars for preservation. It gives that away back to counties to make money. So we're seeing privatization of land that was intended to be public. So that's one of the problems with it. The other one is that the provisions in the bill for wilderness are actually weaker than the Wilderness Act in some areas. And I think that's too bad. It amends the Wilderness Act specifically for that area, for the Boulder White Clouds, making it a little different than the rest of the wildernesses and in the system, although it's an unfortunate trend that has happened with some other wilderness legislation in the past, and it seems to be snowballing. Each bad provision gets rolled over into another bill, and until at what point do you no longer have real protection on the ground? And thirdly, it sets up a special management area where off-road vehicles are given dominance, if not and that's never happened before. And in effect, it amends the existing laws on managing these vehicles on the national forest and other public land system. There are executive orders and regulations agencies have, and this would weaken those and amend those a little bit. So I think by the language. So I think it makes more sense to try to pass a good bill like the Rockies Prosperity, what's now called the Rockies Act, and Rockies Prosperity Act, rather than trying to push through a badly compromised bill, which doesn't really designate real wilderness in the first place. And that's, you know, I know that's controversial among some people, but at what point are we going to wake up and realize that the wilderness system has been so compromised it becomes meaningless? And that's a concern that I have. And now we're in the lame duck session of Congress. Not very much is going to pass. The only way that this Central Idaho bill could pass is through, I think, a rider, which is a sort of a dirty tricks method where you hook it onto something else as part of a bigger bill, which at this point in time would almost have to be what we call an appropriations bill, a bill that spends the money or appropriates the money for the various agencies in which to operate, the government to operate. And that's what they call it, a rider. It rides on that as a provision. So that's what we're looking at. I think it makes a lot more sense for conservationists to even the people that are supporting this severely weakened proposal, I think, down in South Central Idaho, to take a look at it and realize that they could even work with their representative in the coming years with this Congress as it is now, and it will be improved. Mike Simpson, the representative from down there, said that he still wants to go forth with this if it doesn't happen now. And he recognized, he stated this in the paper, that it will be changed and it will be made better from the conservation perspective. That's something that he doesn't particularly want to do, but he has got so much, I think, invested in this that he's willing to do that. And even under that scenario, it's probably better, even if you want to support, that's also good to support this bill as well. Because the soon-to-be, or what we expect soon-to-be, Speaker of the House has said that's one of the top conservation priorities for this House of Representatives in the coming 2 years is to pass this Rockies Prosperity Act, or Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, as it was formerly known. So,
yeah.
So there you have it. And even if this other bill were to be introduced, this bill can only help make it better, and working in tandem would actually achieve the goals of those that want to see protection for the Boulder White Clouds, which is a very deserving area in Idaho and ought to be wilderness.
Bingo. We're going to be talking a little bit more about those bills in another segment of our show today, specifically CEDRA, some of its proponents.
Last concluding thing about this bill is it restores lands and has sets up some pilot projects in some places, somewhat similar to the road removal projects that have been taking place on the Clearwater and the Nez Perce National Forests. Those were really the impetus behind that. Those projects came from the Nez Perce tribe for fish, salmon, and steelhead habitat improvement efforts, and they worked with the Forest Service and got some areas closed. But what this would do was it would actually begin to reconnect. It would either reconnect some large blocks of wild lands together, like removing part of that Magruder Road that divides the Frank Church from Selway Bitterroot, so there's no more road in place there. That's one of the ideas on recovery, in the recovery system. Or recovering some seriously damaged areas, such as part of the Coeur d'Alene watershed, with that legacy of mining and logging up there, in some places 10 miles of road per square mile of land, restoring some of that crucial habitat to prevent, it's not only crucial habitat for things like bull trout, but to prevent continued impacts to Coeur d'Alene Lake and the Coeur d'Alene Basin in terms of lead and other heavy metals and other toxins. So this would help that effort as well. So that's another place in Idaho. But this recovery system would remove roads and use local contractors and people to do so. And road removal requires basically recontouring that road, filling it back in, pulling the cut slope with machinery and putting in, and replanting with native species. It does require native species, which is good. Efforts to try to prevent invasive weeds from being established. And it sets up a special unit within the Forest Service as a National Wildland Recovery Corps. And that will, help carry out this effort and this recovery. So, and it requires recovery plans and then some monitoring to make sure that recovery is doing what it's intended to do.
That's unique. To have that kind of system within this piece of legislation is pretty huge, and I think extremely necessary, and knowing that it's going to work on some pilot recovery efforts for road removal, as well as looking at some polluted areas, some of the lakes in northern Idaho, good measures to be included for sure. Well, we're going to move on to our species of the week, Gary.
All right, Will.
Maybe a well-known species. I'm not too sure. I haven't polled folks, but I do know that a lot of folks are aware of the species, and maybe because they got poked or prodded unexpectedly or expectedly, if they slipped and fell into this this creature here known as the Devil's Club.
Oh, yes.
Gary, you seem to know the Devil's Club pretty well.
It visits a portion of the Clearwater.
It does. This is a coastal disjunct species. Mm-hmm. And found most commonly on the middle fork of the Clearwater, but also on the North Fork.
That is right. There's some in the North Fork and some in, I guess, on the Middle Fork parts in that Research National area, the Loxa, is that?
Yeah, Loxa RNA. Definitely found up in Aquarius RNA.
Aquarius RNA, that's right.
And I'm pretty familiar with Devil's Club. Had some run-ins with it myself. This species is found here in the wild Clearwater country in some disjunct places, and then on the North Pacific coast.
Uh-huh.
Head on up across up through BC all the way up into Alaska.
And it's also found further north, of course, in the Panhandle here in Idaho.
That's right.
Increasing, actually becomes less disjunct the further north one goes, or west, actually, northwest.
It's found in the family Araliaceae, which is known as the maple family, and that's kind of an interesting note. And if you're familiar with the species, you'd know why, because their leaf shape is very similar to that of a maple.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, some of the viburnums, if you know viburnums, also in the maple family, also have that palm shaped leaf, and the leaves of the Devil's Club can be massive, well over a foot across some of the basal leaves, the ones closer to the ground. These massive creatures get up to 9 to 10 feet tall, a really bright spike inflorescence that's white, and they have spikes all the way up their main shoot, and little smaller ones along their leaf branches. They have a big bunch of red berries. Can't miss them. They are a favorite of birds, but they are not edible for us. And they do tend to favor those dark, wet, shaded forests, conifer forests, in this part of the country. Pretty common plant in much of its range.
And Will, have you seen any up on the Loxa country? I haven't seen them there, though I've seen them in the North Fork.
No, I haven't. I haven't seen them on the Loxa. But these plants were also very popular medicinal plants among the Indian peoples here in the interior west for use of all kinds of conditions, including stomach ulcers, thyroid conditions, syphilis, diabetes, even cough syrup and a laxative. The genus name is Oploponax, Oplopanax, excuse me. From the Greek, hoplon, meaning weapon, and panax, which is the name of related another large-leafed plant, Oplopanax horridus. So, reminds me of another horridus out there.
Yeah, horribilis there.
That's right. The great bear.
The great bear, okay.
So, that's our species of the week, Devil's Club.
Well, Will, let's switch gears now and go to our next segment of the program.
All right.
I'm going the peak of the week.
Peaks of the Clearwater. This is
That's
good.
Right.
I like this segment.
Peak of the week. Specific peak that we're going to talk about today, I've been told, and I haven't done a lot of extensive research out on maps within, you know, looking at the contour lines. Other than decide where to go. I usually don't do that. But I haven't done a lot of extensive research looking at my topo maps to find out if this is true. But I have heard this peak is the highest peak in the Clearwater drainage, our peak of the week. And I've been up there, but I don't know for sure because there's a lot of unnamed peaks. So I mentioned on the right along that Idaho-Montana border. And if you just go over the border into Montana, in the Clearwater drainage, you'll find some high peaks that barely exceed 10,000 feet. Trapper's Peak being one. This peak is about a little over a 1,000 feet lower in elevation than Trapper's Peak. It is 8,938 feet, according to the map, in elevation. And it's a very prominent mountain. It's one of the most easily recognizable mountains anywhere in the wild Clearwater country. Just about anywhere you are, you look, and if you can see it, you can recognize it because it looks like the back of a mighty bison. It's called the Buffalo Hump.
Buffalo Hump.
And it's within the Gospel Hump Wilderness. In fact, the peak itself is barely within the wilderness. The summit is within the wilderness, not just on the boundary, but within it. the way the boundary's drawn. Yeah, it was drawn to include the whole peak itself. It forms, it like many of the other mountains in this part of the world, is on a watershed divide. Part of it's in 10 Mile Creek, which flows into the South Fork of the Clearwater, sort of the headwaters right there, on Buffalo Hump there in the south end there. But if you look on the east side of, especially the southeast side of Buffalo Hump, you will see streams flowing into Lake Creek, which starts to head north and then makes a big bend, heads south back into the Gospel Hump Wilderness. It's long. Buffalo Hump is right near that jumbo mining district where there had been a lot of mining, so that area was excluded from the wilderness in the past. Imagine the Gospel Hump Wilderness looks like a mitt. That excluded part is between the index finger and the thumb, that little area. And then it goes back into this thumb part and Lake Creek flows all the way down into Crooked Creek and into the Salmon River. So it's on the Salmon Clearwater Divide, very unique mountain. And again, the area has seen a lot of history on this peak. It's overlooked, some historic mining that took place there in that historic kind of, they call it jumbo mining area. Some people call it that. It's now overlooks, like I say, the Gospel Hump Wilderness. Years past, some people tried to take, did actually take motor vehicles bisecting that on the trail, the Beargrass Trail there, right on the divide between the Salmon and the Clearwater Country, although not over to, the Buffalo Hump Peak itself. Went along there. Some people take, some motorbikes and things like that. But now it's part of the wilderness. And, of course, unfortunately, though, Buffalo Hump, there have been some illegal snowmobile use in the past. And, in fact, one of the snowmobile clubs showed a picture of people snowmobiling, and they were the picture was taken right from the summit. They were right on the summit of Buffalo Hump within the wilderness, and a bunch of us asked the Forest Service to look into that. Nothing ever came of that, unfortunately. But Buffalo Hump became part of the Gospel Hump, again, the hump part after Buffalo Hump wilderness, named from the two peaks, one at the west end and one, this is near the east end of the wilderness. In 1978, it became the Gospel Hump Wilderness, and about 206,000 acre wilderness there, which is contiguous with on the south end, the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. A little extension of that wilderness goes there. So this area is part of the largest roadless area in the lower 48 states. Which includes the Frank Church River of No Return, Gospel Hump, and surrounding unprotected or contiguous unprotected wildland. And Buffalo Hump, the mountain itself, is part of that area. Like I said, the old mining district in the Jumbo area, or some people called it the Buffalo Hump mining area, Oro Grande districts. They were explored in the 1800s even. Some of that country, and a lot of it was done, of course, back then without roads and, on horseback, muleback. And that's why getting into that country is still very, very rugged today. So there you have it, which may be the highest peak. If any listener knows for sure whether there's another point in the Clearwater Basin drainage that is higher than that 89... 38, I think, was the number here. Let's look at the map.
How high
again.
Is Graves Peak, Gary? Is it in high sevens?
That's in high sevens, as I recall. Okay. Let's take a look. I believe that's in the high sevens.
I just have a question about Buffalo Hump. How about how high is Treeline there?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know that we have really know. I think Treeline it's above tree line in a sense, but that may be as much due to the soil and the rocky nature of the actual mountain itself and the parent material from which, you know, this Idaho batholith is derived, mm-hmm. as it has to do with elevational differences. And also a lot of the fires, it appears that a lot of the mountains in the Clearwater may be above tree line, but historic fires burn through a lot of them. But I think, though, that 8,900 feet ought to be close to tree line at this latitude, if not not about a tree line. So it may have some actual true alpine on the top of it. That's that is a very interesting question.
Buffalo Hump. Well, we're going to get into another musical break, and we'll be back for the Whopper of the Week.
Thank you.
you're listening to Michael Petrucciani. It's the Wild Clearwater Country on KRFP Radio Free Moscow. And it's time for the Whopper of the Week.
All right, there we go. Well, this week we're going to give kind of a joint Whopper award. And we're also going to, for an article that appeared in the newspaper, we're going to give an Elkburger award.
Elkburger, all right.
And the Whopper goes to, maybe surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, a couple conservationists who are still pushing the severely tainted Central Idaho Economic Development Recreation Act, which would give away public lands in spite of the fact most Idahoans don't want to give away our public lands. And even Butch Otter reversed course on that and said, oops, I was wrong to want to give away public lands or sell them for Katrina relief. He would sell them. This one is going to give them away to a local counties for them to sell for trophy home development and whatnot. And the awards go to Rick Johnson of Idaho Conservation League and Craig Yerke of the Wilderness Society. The Whoppers this week for suggesting that we have to continue and, in fact, try and push this bill right now through the lame duck session. If they want to push the bill later, you know, it might become a good bill. But why push it right now in the lame duck session? Which really, according to this article, that's what would happen. And 80 conservation organizations, and this was well before, unfortunately this article is a little bit misleading because this is well before the elections happened, 80 conservation groups, you know, it was weeks before, if not
months several months,
three months maybe, something like that, wrote a letter and suggesting that now is not a good time to try to do this kind of a bill because they include too many exemptions and trade-offs in return for too little protection. And so, you know, that lays the groundwork there for the Whoppers of the Whopper of the Week. The Whoppers soon going to them. And I would add as an addendum any editorial writers for local newspapers.
Yeah, apparently Jim Fisher jumped on board.
He's gotten them in the past, so he maybe can join in this Whopper
again.
It's
a triumvirate.
A try Whopper here, a shared Whopper for supporting this effort that goes back on. Jim Fisher says, well, it's a good compromise. Well, the thing about Fisher is he doesn't support the compromise of the Wilderness Act because this goes back on the provisions of the Wilderness Act and further weakens them in terms of in some very, very specific areas. For example, it allows routine helicopter and flights for routine wildlife management. That's never been landings in the wilderness. That's never been part of the Wilderness Act. In fact, it's only under special conditions for and only if it's for, you know, wilderness purposes. So that's one of the exemptions in Central Idaho Economic and Development Recreation Act. That's quite a phrase there. And since I have a cold, I'm sort of stumbling over my words today, Will. But
that's all right.